I am a god.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your talk to me nice or don't talk to me twice of music, news, and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica. It is the mailbag episode. A couple times a year, we like to solicit on the Facebook group and in the Discord. I did go in the Discord recently. It is, in fact, jumping. It's my bad. It's my bad for not being in the Discord. There's a lot of takes. There's a lot of memes going. Some memes I had not seen. There were new memes in the Discord. Fresh memes.
Is that why the Facebook group is quiet these days?
I feel like the Facebook group's a little quiet, and maybe the kind of day-to-day energy is going over to the Discord. Although I will say, I feel like the Facebook group, I'm getting a lot of like long threads, but maybe not as many threads, but they're long, but they're maybe not as plentiful. A lot of responses.
The depth is always there.
Yes, but there are like fresh memes in the Discord if anybody is in need of some. And of course, at the email and on Twitter, some crucial questions coming through on Twitter. So we're going to tackle a bunch. The gang is here. First of all, John Perellis is here, chief pop music critic of the New York Times. JP, what's good, man? Are you ready for these bars?
You promised big picture questions.
There are big picture questions. I promise that.
Is that how you lured JP to the podcast?
I did. I felt like I needed to salt the bait a little bit.
It sounded like a threat to me.
We'll find out. Check back in 30 minutes. Karen Ganza's here, refusing to turn on her camera. Hi, Karen.
You don't have to tell the people my policies.
Or an audio sound alike. Who knows? Who can really say?
The deepfake, Karen.
Yeah, it's true.
We had not had camera on options in the past, and I we did well before. Why, if it ain't broke?
First of all, we'll know if it's the real Karen by her answer to the first question when we get to it. We'll know if it's real or not. And finally, checking in from a wood-paneled room in an undisclosed beach location, it's Joe Coscarelli, a.k.a. Jose. It's Joe Balvin. How you doing, bro?
I'm here.
Looking great. Hair's looking great.
I'm like half working, half hanging, so here I am.
How's that different from any other Wednesday? Let's be honest.
Exactly. Perfect for a podcast.
Keep it a buck. First of all, I just want to start off with two quick shout outs because every now and again, I will bump into someone in the streets who listens to podcasts. I just want to say hi. I want to say hi to Kelsey, who pulled up on me at some taco place in the East Village. Shout out, Kelsey. Very kind, very lovely. And also to Jasmine from Los Angeles, who was at Joe's Pizza at 9 or 10 p.m. when I was in Joe's Pizza with Dan. Hi, Dan, if you're listening. And Jasmine, her friend, were there. They listened to podcasts, but then they were not going to the Pink Panther show. So what are you going to do? Anyway, hello, Kelsey. Hello, Jasmine. First question. It's coming from Andrew Gogg. And again, I want to say up front, it's open season on bad pronunciation, so please forgive me. Andrew wants to know, and Karen, I need you to get prepped. Not that I have any visual evidence that you would do so. Andrew would like to know, it's been almost 5 years since the controversial rock episode of Popcast.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wait, what was controversial about it?
I'll finish the question. Do you feel tempted to revisit the state of rock music with the pop punk resurgence and the big bands of that episode, Greta Van Fleet and the 1975, kind of fading into the background of pop consciousness? I think the other question, and someone else asked this, which I'll come to next, is, Karen, is rock back?
Huh. Oh, man, how to answer. It's getting back. Oh, for that, John Perrell has put on his camera. Now I really
so good by the question.
Oh, my God.
Like an apparition, John Perrell has just appeared when you asked me if rock was back.
He was like, I'm on the call. The call's coming from inside the Zoom.
Is your name Greg? John Perellis, did you ask the question? I think there's a lot to unpack there. Greta Van Fleet had a very interesting arc. I think that first record was very big and very criticized. And then they put out another record, and I thought no one really cared.
That's accurate.
The 1975, people still care. I don't feel like they're out of business. I think that there's probably something cooking there. I can't remember who else we talked about on that episode. Before the pandemic, I had prognosticated that rock was coming back. I felt like the pandemic derailed slightly, but more back than it was 5 years ago.
Rock is everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, it's in Latin pop. It's all over the place. Pop punk is definitely resurging in odd corners of the universe.
I don't think I've ever thought I would say this sentence on Popcast, but Rock is back.
Rock signifiers are back, at least.
Yes, yes.
Today I opened my email to new album from the Yeah Yeah Yeahs coming soon, new album from Panic at the Disco coming soon. Obviously, Harry Styles is the star of the moment. He's pretending to be a rock star. Left and right, everyone is tapping in either to something that they used to do and are now doing again, or like in the pop punk sense, borrowing for pop, for hip hop, for Latin music. Just, I don't know. It's like guitars are everywhere. The Olivia Rodrigo show, if you saw this tour, opens with the first song from the album, Brutal, with the prom set. Halfway through, I just turned to my friend who I was with and I said, this is Nirvana. There's just nothing else to, like, there's nothing else to say. And I meant it in all senses. Like, it was both referencing Nirvana and actually Nirvana.
Literally every Rolling Stone editor of the 1990s just simultaneously dropped dead when you said that. Literally every single one. We send condolences. I'm so sorry. Okay. Yes. That's a little bit strong on the Nirvana thing. But yes, I also think that, to your point about signifiers, this is something that we've seen spiraling outwards, certainly within pop, moving towards pop punk, but also in the kind of 1.0 and 2.0 eras of SoundCloud rap, taking on the guise of like rock star presentation. And then increasingly, even if you want to look at like the ongoing work of like Trippie Redd or somebody who like still sells a lot of tour tickets and still like moves a lot of units, they're making quasi rock records. And that's always been part of that narrative as well. I don't know if it trickled back into kind of like mainstream hip hop necessarily, but all of these subsets, and JP, to your point, certainly happening in Latin pop as well, are finding fresh energy in rock. But let me ask this question, because there's another rock question. This is from Ben Zimmerman. Ben is asking about Turnstile, and we're going to get Turnstile next. But Ben wants to know, who's the next big rock act, and what does the reemergence say about the ebb and flow of genre and taste? Part of me thinks that post-COVID, many or all of us want to bang our heads to huge riffs more than ever. So is the resurgence of rock somehow tied to the reemergence of physicality in music, which is to say, being in spaces with people or just having a reaction to a song that exists outside of the confines of your home office?
I think what rock is now is not progressive in any way. It's all backward looking to me, with a few exceptions. Maybe Turnstile is one of them, and they're looking backwards as well, but you can make the argument that they're evolving a sound or a genre or a mood. And I think this has been true of rock historically, that it's always in conversation with a past version of itself. And I don't know that we're going to have a new big rock band that's going to take over. But I think what you are going to have are pop stars and rappers and pop star rappers and whoever.
Machine Gun Kelly.
Yeah, using the toolkit and twisting it. I don't know if we're approaching a rock revival in terms of zeitgeist, right? Like, I just don't think like four guys in a band or three guys and a front woman in a band are going to be the thing. It's going to be more piecemeal than that.
Ben's right about the physicality of wanting to bang your head. It is nice to be in a room where everything is too loud and there's a giant power cord bouncing around the molecules of the atmosphere. And rock does feel more communal than SoundCloud rap did. It doesn't feel like someone in their room. It does feel like people who got together for a purpose or to just have fun. So I do think that the opportunity to be in physical spaces is helping a bit. But I think Joe's right in that rock feels like a pose now. I'm a rocker. This makes me rebellious because I am holding an electric guitar on which I know how to play two chords. It is a fashion thing as well as a sonic thing.
Are there rock bands you guys are excited about? Because JP, you wrote that story recently.
Yeah, Porridge Radio. Porridge Radio.
And I've really been enjoying that album since reading you on it. Do you feel like there are a lot of these bands bubbling right under?
There probably are. Horse Girl's about to release an album. They're all escaping me at the moment. But it may be that after our enforced isolation, people do want to go to a club. And rock sounds good in a club. You don't need the sound, lights, dancers, confetti of an arena show to just go out and have a good time. So I'm hoping that there is a resurgence, revival, upwelling of mid-level rock, Bowery ballroom size rock. That to me sounds like a good night out.
let's listen to something from Porridge Radio. This is The Rip from the most recent Porridge Radio album.
And now my heart aches, 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 and now my heart aches.
Karen, let me ask a question. Obviously, like, one of the recurring punchline themes of Popcast is you advocating for rock and me telling you to stop. So that's always like a fun push and pull. But let's leave aside the aesthetic specifics of any particular band or any particular song or album. Do you think, in the big picture, Ben is asking about the ebb and flow of genre, is there not just simply an inevitability that people will cycle back towards music of this nature? Is there a chance that it really could have been any band at this time that gets a lot of attention? Because eventually people will tire of what's currently filling up the pop charts and want to move back in this direction. And if someone like Olivia helps nudge in that direction, like, so much the better.
Sure. Rock never went anywhere, but just it moved a little left of the center. And there aren't as many artists that can fill a stadium. That was the thing we always said about Foo Fighters. And I was like, just there aren't that many bands right now that are going to book MSG. And then you end up with smaller bands booking venues like that, and it doesn't work quite right. But I think, remember, it wasn't that long ago we did our piece about all the young women keeping rock alive. They were there the whole time, and they're still there, and they're putting out even more albums. There's a Soccer Mommy album coming. But in terms of the, like, 15-year generational return, is it like the Saturn return of all the bands from the early 2000s? I feel like the Yeah Yeah Yeahs having an album out this fall is a beacon of that.
And also, what was that festival that was just in LA that was like all the early 2000s bands? I forget the name of it.
Oh, yeah. It's named after a Cure song, Just Like Heaven.
That feels like a nostalgia play. Like, I kind of wonder, like, a band that's starting right now or started in the last 3 to 5 years, could you envision a 2025 arena tour for a rock band that's a new rock band right now? A rock band in the classic mold?
Maybe at some point it all swings back around. And again, also this year, there's like the My Chemical Romance tour. There's so much nostalgia this year. So it is hard to think about how things will break out of that. Someone's going to be headlining MSG with a guitar in 10 years.
Yes. Ian Dior. Yeah. The person is going to be there.
I think our hope is always that it's going to be like Soccer Mommy, but really what it's going to be is Imagine Dragons. It can be uncool and extremely popular. And I think that is like the more viable path for like commercial, mainstream, top of the charts rock.
How about someone who you just wrote about, Joe, Ethel Kane? She's very rock. I can see her headlining.
I saw her first New York show last week at Market Hotel, and she's coming back to New York in the fall. And I think the Bowery shows are already sold out. They just added a third show. Like, that's happening. It's guitar based, but I think it's people are responding to it less in a rock way than in a singer-songwriter way. Is Florence a rock band? Yes, but also no, it's just Florence. You know, Ethel is walking that line in an interesting way. And I think she won't necessarily be married to the signifiers of a rock band as she continues to make music, if I had to guess.
Can I inject a comment from the Discord here? And apologies to the person who posted this, but I thought I had typed your user handle, but it seems to have disappeared, but you'll know who you are. And the comment is simply this: a tour called Pop Punk's Not Dead, headlined by Olivia Rodrigo and MGK, with The Story So Far, Knuckle Punk, and State Champs as supporting acts. Send tweet. Would go.
Done. Yeah.
Let's go. Like, Popcast field trip. We're all going.
Don't forget this fall, also those 2 days of giant festivals in Vegas, headlined by Paramore and My
Chemical
Romance.
Oh, yeah, we're going to that too. Yeah, hell yeah, we're going to that. And speaking of MGK and the Pop Punk Revival Tour, obviously we opened with what is destined to be a modern classic, that is Emo Girl by MGK and Willow. And if you don't know all the words to that, you're probably listening to the wrong podcast. That's all I have to say. Okay, the next question, this is the Turnstile. There's actually several Turnstile questions, which I think tells you a lot about where Turnstile sits right now in the consciousness of people who care about music. That's a little bit forward-thinking. This is from Connor Fitzpatrick. And Connor, first of all, I want you to know I'm onto your game. That's the first thing I want to say. Here's Connor's question. And Karen, this is also going to go to you, and you'll understand why in a second. Connor says, I'm curious what you think of the rise in popularity of Turnstile. I know they're classified as a hardcore band, but to me, they feel more spiritually connected to hashtag live mus bands like Jane's Addiction, Incubus, and 311. What do you think makes them the band to carry the torch for the hashtag live mus movement? Now, Connor, I want to say, I did a Twitter search of Turnstile and hashtag live mus, and it turned up exactly one result, and that is a playlist that you made on Spotify. So if the goal of this question was to get me to say live mus and Turnstile on Popcast, congratulations. If the goal was to get Karen to talk about her love of Taco Bell and Turnstile, also congratulations, because that's about to happen.
And you can even add a third vector to this, Demi Lovato, who also loves Turnstile and Taco Bell. All these things are coming together.
They are indeed living mus.
They are. And promising new music in this sort of vein. Well, in a poppier vein.
Karen, I'm going to send you this playlist because I think it's very much your wave. What's your vibe on Turnstile generally? Let's temp check Turnstile.
Oh, I like Turnstile a lot. I know that I would lump Jane's Addiction, 311, and Incubus into any sort of pile in any way. And I guess maybe from 30,000 feet, I can see it. I mean, Jane's Addiction is one of my favorite bands of all time. They're more genre melders with a super dark underbelly. Incubus, not that dark. 311, weedy. So I don't know that I'm seeing all the connections here. But I mean, Turnstile, they have the, as hardcore as they can be, they do have the capacity to step back and be slightly more musical or emotional. So I guess I can see these things. But as for why they are the band of the moment, I don't know. I really thought that you were going to say something about 100 Gex. That seems more like the band of the moment. No, am I crazy?
Sidebar conversation, where are 100 Gecs?
Yeah.
We'll come back to it. Joe, are you living mus? What's your read on Turnstile?
I don't have a critic's take on Turnstile, but just in terms of them being like a band that is plucked to become a stand-in for something more, like people just want bands to be fans of. This is the Big Thief thing. Turnstile, yes, is Big Thief.
Literally.
Not musically, but culturally. Like I've started
I think
the
more Def Heaven, actually, but yes, go on.
But I think Def Heaven has been riding that wave. And I think Turnstile is new to it. Like I've started seeing Turnstile t-shirts in, forgive me, basic crowds. You know what I mean? Like just normal ass people in normal ass places wearing Turnstile shirts.
Everyone who submitted a Turnstile question, Joe just called you basic. So I'm
no,
so sorry.
No, I did not. It has graduated.
Joe said, where was your Turnstile question 3 mailbags ago? Like real talk, where was it?
Like we talked about them 3 mailbags ago when somebody asked about the future of hardcore and a hardcore episode, which you still owe them with Tom.
And I'm glad you brought that up because, okay, obviously the most immediate analog for Turnstile in terms of arc, not necessarily in terms of music, but in terms of arc, is Trash Talk. And the Trash Talk arc of the early to mid 2010s to me parallels the Turnstile arc of the last like 3 to 4 years. Now, obviously, I find them to be musically very different. Their relation to like pure hardcore, different. We are going to do a hardcore episode. Tom Bryan, you're on duty. Chris Ryan, you're on duty. When I was in LA recently, Chris was telling me about all kind of hardcore bands that he's into that are contemporary hardcore bands that he goes to. And we were all at dinner and then we were talking about Power Violence. And then I ended up buying a Spaz t-shirt like on eBay at the dinner table. So like we're going down that road. That's going to be a big summer hit. JP, what do you make of Turnstile musically? And also just in general, this notion that people's relationship, I think, to hardcore, it can be such an insular conversation, but there is this desire to kind of like, how can I pluck something from it and make it feel like a little bit more expansive as an ecosystem?
Turnstile has managed to hold on to its base while not being as purist. They actually have tunes, my goodness.
It's a vibey band.
It's a vibey band, but they also have melodies. They also have stuff you can sing along with. And I think that they've stepped outside that hardcore prison a little bit. And that makes people buy the t-shirts who weren't there 3 years ago. So it's nice to, Joe, you were talking about singer-songwritery, Ethel Cain versus rock. And I think people still like that idea of a rock band as a gang, as a posse, as people who got together for a purpose. And Turnstile does that. Trash Talk didn't throw melodies into the mix. And that's why they plateaued.
I think their goals were different in terms of expanding quote unquote hardcore. And there was also that weird mid 2010s movement where you'd see a festival and it would be like Trash Talk and like Antoine and like basically underground rappers and hardcore bands coexisting in a kind of like post warehouse system.
The Death Grips.
We don't say those words on podcasts, but yeah, generally speaking. So you think Turnstile could plateau higher, has higher upside potential than Trash Talk, specifically because of the directions that their musical expansion is taking.
Exactly. And people do like melodies. People do like something they can hold on to as well as just the basic assault. And I think that's what Turnstile is mixing into their hardcore.
Last rock question for now. This is a little bit more niche. This is from Alistair Keddy. And Alistair wants to know, with Bring Me the Horizon doing Sigrid, Ed Sheeran, and MGK collabs, do you think that they will be poised to break through more, especially in North America, or are they just stuck in that post-Warp Tour and Radio Rock bubbles? I did not know there was a Sigrid collab with Bring Me the Horizon. I think that this is part of the larger nostalgia arc that we've been talking about, of people just like reaching back to the past and pulling a band. Like, I don't know that there's like a new hump. Anybody feel strongly about it, one way or the other?
I would just say never underestimate the desire for label and radio white men of a certain age to want to like make something happen that is extremely legible to them.
Because those systems exist and they have to continually reify the systems in order to save their own jobs, basically. If I was building radio stations from scratch, like terrestrial radio, I would not build a rock radio station. Like I'd build, like, frankly, an MGK Pandora station. That's what the rock station would be. But yes, those guys, damn.
And you meet those guys in that MGK Venn diagram, right? There is some overlap. And I think that Bring Me the Horizon, again, say what you will about them musically, but benefits from the idea that there should be that energy in pop right now, which goes back to the first rock question and the pop punk revival and all of the different lanes of that.
Also, let's not underestimate Ed Sheeran's urge to recombine. Let's not underestimate his willingness to like try anything with anybody. He may be using them more than they are using him.
Ed Sheeran said one of the funniest things to me in an interview that any artist has ever said in the context of an interview. At the end of our time together, we probably spent a full day together of conversation and ride along and whatever. And at the end, I'm packing my stuff up and he says, can I ask you a question? And I'm not going to do an Ed Sheeran accent. Everybody will be relieved to hear that. And I said, sure. And he said, do you rate my music? And if you're unfamiliar with British slang, then you do like my music. And he wasn't like fishing for a compliment. He just genuinely, I think, was flummoxed after a full day together. I think he was just basically like, it's cool if you don't. Like, I totally understand loads of people don't like my music. And I was like, oh, that's like a little bit heartbreaking. Like, I wouldn't have spent like this entire trip with you. I wouldn't have flown to wherever the hell we are to interview you if I didn't think that you made good music. But I just thought it was a very funny and classically humble Ed Sheeran thing to say. Should we listen to the Ed Sheeran and Bring Me the Horizon collaboration real fast?
Why not?
It's either a very humble thing for him to say or a very, I talked to John Caramonica for 8 hours. I'm still not sure what he thinks. Thing to say.
Fair. Also fair.
Just speaking from the other perspective.
Yes, and also that's part of the sauce, baby. So this is Bad Habits, which is a cover of Ed Sheeran's Bad Habits, just with Bring Me the Horizon.
Every pure intention ends when the good times stop. Falling over everything to reach the first time.
I'm Anna Martin, the host of the Modern Love podcast. In every episode, we peek into an intimate corner of someone's life and learn about what love means to them.
You know, I can tell you 35 years with another person, I've never spent that much time with anyone else either.
So we both kind of said, I love you pretty fast.
My advice is that it's okay if it's hard.
You can listen to Modern Love wherever you get your podcasts.
The next question comes from, and this is a name I may not get right. It's either Jael or Jael Holtzman. And first of all, a reporter with Politico, hello to our friends in Washington, just wanted to ask, do you think Chance the Rapper will ever live down the big day? Okay, I'm going to answer that question simply by reading the subject heading of the most recent email that I have received from a Chance the Rapper publicist. And that says, Chance the Rapper drops new interdisciplinary art piece and single.
And we did not cover it, I will point out.
I have a slight counterpoint. I have a slight counterpoint.
You came on podcast to defend the arc of Chance the Rapper, the recent arc of Chance the Rapper. Wow. You've really been on the beach a long time.
I love an online backlash. I love an online backlash. I love jokes. The jokes are so fun. Like, the jokes are so funny. He'll never live down the guy rapping about his wife parody. I get it all, but like, Chance the Rapper he's a very talented artist. Like, he's made some really good music.
First two tapes, phenomenal.
Yeah, and you can already see people like slowly starting to remember that. I think it's smart, actually, what he did from a rollout and marketing perspective. He was dropping these like minute long little teasers of just like good rapping pretty much only on Twitter.
And he's a very good rapper.
Yeah, he's a very good rapper. He's doing the right things. I think his replies will always be in shambles for the foreseeable future, maybe all of time until Elon does away with the blue bird. But I think like he's going to surprise a lot of people because the expectations are so low and his talent level is so high that it's just like he made a bad album. Like, it's fine.
What do you make of his interdisciplinary art piece?
Look, I'm not engaging with the interdisciplinary art piece at this moment, but I'm waiting to see what he does.
Okay, I might have to tap in with Jason Farrago to find out about the interdisciplinary, if that's making waves in the art community. So just throwing that out there. Okay, next question. This is coming from Robin Bockhoff. Robin says, from a European perspective, Young Lean seems like one of the most innovative contemporary rappers in terms of sound and also to some extent fashion, yada, 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 Quavo, Travis Scott, Sick Boy Rari, Denzel Curry. I guess what I am trying to get at is Young Lean a less vulturous, more organic, and downscaled European version of Drake, or just some weird Swedish kid that used to rap about selling heroin? Where is the Young Lean episode? Yes to both of those things. Yes. Honestly, fair question. Maybe more of a 2018 question, but still, fair question. Also, Young Lean was with Kanye not that long ago. Young Lean, Curio or World Changer? Anybody? Wow. Quiet. It's quiet. It's quiet.
The Young Lean song with FKA Twigs, really good.
Yep.
The Rise of Drain Gang, obviously attributable largely to Young Lean. He's not going to get his due, probably, but he'll be considered extremely, influential in the medium and long term, because he's done a lot of cool stuff and continues to. We're in this business where your moment is your moment and then you're just a cult favorite, and I think that's okay.
But I also think like Young Lean might like mess around and end up with a weird kind of like crooner pop album when he's 35.
Can't wait.
Yeah, like he might just absolutely f*** around and make a midlife classic. Totally possible. JP, you on the Lean train? Are you on Drain Gang?
I like Drain Gang, but he could end up as a collaborator. He could end up as someone that people call on to supply that 16 bars of Young Leanness.
Or just songwriting, just pure songwriting.
Someone like Miguel, who's like incredibly talented, but ends up being the feature all the time.
Tobias Leno Jr., like totally could happen.
First time a Young Lean has ever been compared to Miguel, but I love it. I don't know. I think Bliss, song and video, one of my favorites of the year so far, I would say.
Let's listen to that. This is Young Lean with FKA Twigs. It's called Bliss. The key and the gate is a lean world. I'm in a king of my life, but the key goes splash, 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 so icy like the sea world. Got to know I'm here, go me see. City, city blue, like the summer was. Let my eyes right, glass, you can tell it works. Still going in, baby, you can still have it all. With the white dress, when the night falls. This next question, it's for everyone, but it's for me. This is from Mano Sundaresan. Mano writes about hip-hop, and Mano, he has some questions about my relationship to Yeet. I need the official Popcast take. Is Yeet the future? Is he good? Is he the white rapper du jour? Does he remind you of anybody from a previous era, musically or career-wise? Now, okay, Joe is doing some head motions, but I want to also add a little bit of context. A couple weeks ago on Twitter, there was a tweet exchange that suggested that critics, myself should be a little bit more curmudgeonly when it comes to, basically a little bit more Chris Gowlish when it comes to new music. And Mano was in this conversation, and a bunch of it's been deleted, but I found one tweet. And the one tweet is, this is from at Gnarly Hefner responding to at HD Angel. And when we have the Yeet episode, y'all can just come on. We could do this in real time. But this tweet said, I think Caramonica should be more honest with how he feels and stop pretending to like people like Yeet. Lol.
Let's go. Rebuttal now.
Oh, my God.
You have 15 seconds.
First of all, here's a bell. That's number one. Okay. Yeet is good leaning, very good, is what I think. The innovations, Joe is taking the curmudgeon role. Wait, first of all, let me finish. The plasticity of the last seven or eight years, especially coming out of Atlanta and post-Atlanta rap, combined with the kind of like raw scabrousness of the early wave of SoundCloud rap, Yeet is someone who really, his entire hip-hop vocabulary basically only comes from those two movements, and his sound does feel like a real collision or admixture of those two ideas. I mostly like it. The albums are very long. There's not a lot of tonal variation song to song, but generally speaking, I don't want to turn it off when it's on. And also recently I was at a thrift warehouse store near my house, and they were playing End to End Yeet, and I had a great time for an hour. And then when I went to check out, I said to the guy, I was like, oh, you really like Yeet? And he was like, I don't know who that is. It's in the air. It's in the culture. It's moving. So anyway, Gnarly Hefner, I'm being honest. That's where I'm at. I'm not going to come at you with a Chris Gow C-. How about a B? I'll give a B. Joe, you are chomping at the Yeet. Chomping at the Yeet.
I'm not. I want to say I just always rather listen to Yeet's influences than listen to Yeet, period. And then I would also say, secondarily, if people got uncut off the page John Caramonica opinions, it would only make them more angry.
Wait, without specifying a specific opinion, can you explicate that a little bit?
If anything, you're faking in the other direction.
Fakating?
No. I don't think you're faking in general, but I just think if you express your pure, like people who listen to podcasts know, if you were expressing your true opinions on Yeet, they would be what you just said. Like, you're not lying, basically, is what I'm saying.
No.
Are you not lying, but you're tempering your love.
My enthusiasm. I'm tempering my enthusiasm. Yeah. I have the taste of a 12-year-old. I'm sorry. And to all those folks, there's always this kind of like occasional discourse on Twitter or every now and again on ILM for those people who still post in there that like think that I'm like fabricating this. And it's like, actually, no, like I have ADD and I only like music that's designed for young people. And I apologize to the people who can't handle that. If it breaks your notion of what a critic should be, I can't help that. I don't do it for you. I do it for me. I do it for JP. I do it for Joe. And I do it for Karen. And that's it. And also now I do it for Gnarly Hefner and HD Angel. Can't wait to hear from you guys. So anyway, we had to just talk about that. JP, that makes me think that we got to get to one of the bigger picture questions that I baited you with. First of all, JP, no guarantee that JP was going to come on the mailbag episode. So let's ask this. Oh, wait, we should play a Yeet song. Sorry, let's play Turban by Yeet. Every time they want to lay about it, I'm going to ask them about it, cut it, blow. Bring it up, what's up, what's up, whoa, 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 has a question about what we do, why we do what we do, and perhaps how we do what we do. Stephen, or Stefan, again, apologies, wants to know, having grown up in the world of classical music, it has always struck me how much the discourse around pop music focuses on the branding / fashion / social media / lyrical references surrounding the music, and rarely ever on what I would describe as literally the music, i.e. its sonic composition. There was a recent debate in the Facebook group about whether critical discussion of an artist's social media habits is basically a waste of time. What do you think is the right balance among this stuff? And is it different from what it was 20 years ago? What even is the, quote, job of a music critic? LOL. As an 18-year-old, I do not know what it was like 20 years ago, so I can't answer that part of the question. JP, let's first start with the big picture, which is, to what degree did these extra musical, quote unquote, aspects of an artist's presentation, should they factor in to the work that we do?
Well, it really depends on who it is. I do think it has changed because, for one thing, there was none of this social media infestation 20 years ago. But the other thing is that the job of the popular artist has changed because they don't have to, but largely do present themselves on social media, on Instagram, on Twitter. They're doing their artistic statement through those media as well as through whatever song you're listening to through your headphones.
It's all a package in your mind.
It's not so much being a musician as being a pop star. And those are two overlapping but different jobs now.
Are you more apt in the year 2022 when you're writing about, especially a big record, like a big pop record, not a smaller indie artist, but when you're writing about a big pop star record or a big rock band or a big rap record, do you feel that the percent of your time that you give over to these like extra musical concerns is greater than it was? Because obviously there was no TikTok 10 to 15 years ago, but there were other things. There were tabloids. There were interview intrigue. There was tour stuff. There was public-facing romantic drama. Like, there's all this other kind of stuff. Do you feel, as far as you trying to give like the most thoughtful consideration of what an artist is doing on a record, how much do you feel you're taking into account what else is happening in the era? And do you think that's grown compared to 10 or 20 years ago?
It's definitely grown. There's no question. Even classic rock artists are mouthing off on social media somewhere. I'm very ear dominated. I still listen to the music.
Let me do a little editorial parachuting in. JP's copy, he engages with the music and the lyrics more than anybody I have read in the past 10, 15 years, particularly with the lyrics. You do not read a JP review without really understanding what the album is about. And having spoken to artists that you've written about, I know how much that means to them. You're truly listening, but musically, you're hearing things about meters and tones. And you give it a deeper read. And while I know, and as you just said, you do engage with social media and art and artist presentation, it's exceptionally rare that you would let that trump the actual musical presentation. I really feel like when I read a profile or a JP review, I'm getting a very close read of an artist or an album, which I really appreciate because that's just increasingly rare. When I go to interview an artist, I spend a lot of time digging through their social media. And then halfway through the interview, I'm like, oh, am I asking too much about this and not focusing enough about the actual album itself? And I will try to channel JP. So I applaud you, JP. I really think that you've held very close to the true critical mission here without closing your eyes to these things that are happening around us.
You want to use the tools you need for the job. And luckily, Joe and JC write a lot more about these people whose entire careers are based on beefs and clothes and things that don't make my ears happy. So I'm really just following my basic sensory orientation. The stuff I write about is the stuff where what's in the grooves, remember grooves? What's in the grooves predominates, what's in the ones and zeros. But I'm glad John Caramanica, I'm glad Joe Coscarelli are willing to parse hours of tweets and TikToks and whatever. It's not my thing. But I think that if I were writing about Young Lean, that would be important.
Who I'm thinking about in this moment is Lil Nas X, who we've written about ad nauseum, but often for extra musical reasons. That is because, you know, I am of the mindset, as I've said on podcasts multiple times, that the true art of Lil Nas X is public-facing stardom. That is what Lil Nas X's art form is. And I still truly once or twice a week absolutely lose my when I think of Joe asking me in the Grammy Diary of a Song, is Lil Nas X a song? Is this music? And I literally lose my for a couple reasons. One, we were on camera. Two, Joe knows perfectly well what I think the answer to that question is, and I absolutely have never felt more set up by a dear friend than I have in that moment. I think you cannot write about Lil Nas X. I think you cannot responsibly write about Lil Nas X without engaging these other concerns. But also, I feel like any time that I have written about Lil Nas X's music, I have tried to be as detailed and focused about why I think it is not successful as music, while also understanding that the mode of Lil Nas X may not be totally reliant on music. You can say this, heaven forbid, and again, don't at me, but like recent BTS singles that are designed specifically for American pop radio crossover are frankly, to my ears, not as musically successful as earlier BTS records, but also literally does not matter because the train is moving. A lot of the discourse around BTS is not specifically musical discourse. And every now and again, when I do write about K-pop in a musically detailed way, I'll see a few tweets amidst the kind of negative tweets. I'll see a few tweets to say, oh, we're happy to see a critic engaging with the music just like they would engage with any American pop star or any American celebrity. So I would like to see more of that. That's an inverse answer to that question, which is sometimes I think there's so much coverage of the non-musical aspect that you're actually starving out coverage of the music.
It's all of it. Like music and pop and the music business specifically, therefore music journalism and music criticism is about the place where all of this stuff meets. The Beatles, Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, like their mythology, their celebrity, all of that played a role in who they were, how they were covered, how you hear their music, the interplay between the songs and the persona. And I think it's our job and in different ways to parse all of those things. And we try to do it from all angles and often taking a cue, as JP said, from the artists themselves about what's important here.
Let's listen to an unsuccessful Lil Nas X song. This is One of Me featuring Elton John. If it ain't no town road, Lil Nas, he ain't playing. Just stick to what you best. And I suggest make another one like this. Huh, yeah, oh, I know it hurt your soul to know it was only luck. Huh, if you drop a song, we won't give a fuck, no. Next question is related to this. It's a little bit of a quick hit. And Karen, this is something you and I talked about earlier this week. This is from Carla Candela. And Carla wants to know, what are your thoughts on artists speaking out on the TikTok content compliances that they need to deliver in return for releasing their songs? And what I think is that those artists are lying. That's what I mostly think, is that they're making it up. Or that they're overstating the case. Artists have always had to do marketing and promotion. I'm not sure that TikTok is any more onerous than any other form of marketing promotion. Also, there are literally so many people who are good at TikTok that it's actually a little weird to see artists being like, I'm not good at TikTok, when literally there's 1,000 artists waiting to take your place who are exceptional at it. So I'm maybe a little unsympathetic to that particular narrative arc, even though it did make for an interesting news cycle.
I suggested that an artist could play a snippet of their song over like a standing glass of water, and that would count as a TikTok.
Yeah.
As you said, John, marketing has always been a part of the job, and pushing back against the marketing required, especially the new form of it, has always been something that the artist is supposed to do. Metallica refused to make music videos for MTV because they thought it was lame. And then eventually they made music videos.
Yeah, popular. Neil Young being a pain in the ass. This is a long history of labor pushing back against the oligarchs.
Yeah, I think it's fine. I think it's a healthy dialogue, and I don't think anybody is really being held hostage.
I also think they're lying. So that's just that's another thing.
The main case that we're alluding to, without getting into detail, like, it worked and we're all going to hear that song and
the Halsey song.
Yeah, it'll succeed or it'll fail on its merits.
But also, do you not think that like it's basically anti-marketing, like that the tweet about my label won't put out the song without a successful TikTok, that someone either on her management or her label.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, it worked.
Right. But it worked in the sense that it was a marketing technique. It didn't work because it was a pure complaint from the deep soul of an artist.
I think it could be both.
Yeah, I don't know. Okay, let's do a little bit of lightning round, because there's a bunch of interesting quick questions. Okay, this one's coming from Matt Bermudez. Matt wants to know, has Adele done real material damage to her image and career with the whole Vegas fiasco? I can say for me, having my money in limbo with no date in sight, all over petty production issues, I probably won't purchase an Adele record again. Which, the fact that people are still purchasing Adele records, that's the buried lead in that. What do we think about where Adele is right now? My feeling is that Adele is not bracing for restarting the Vegas show. It does not feel that. It feels like it's dissipated and trying to be pushed. They're trying to memory hole that a little bit.
Can't wait to see her at the NBA Finals. I think the problem is broader than the Vegas show. And I think the problem then the next layer up is broader than Adele. And I think that's the Adele generation of artists, the Drakes of the world, etc. Like their last albums, almost to a person, didn't do what their previous albums did. There's not hits on this Adele album. There's not hits on Certified Lover Boy, Beyonce. We say this over and over again, but like that generation is getting old. And I think, yeah, screwing up the Vegas thing doesn't help because that's really probably where her bread and butter was going to be. I think they're all going to, all the A plus list stars of the 2010s are going to have to figure something out. And if it's not in Vegas, then it's going to have to be somewhere else.
I agree with that. And I'll be very curious to see what happens with the Chromatica ball this summer. Like, what an unbelievably bad idea that Lady Gaga has decided to like 2 years belatedly tour an album that really wasn't that well received. I know that we probably gave it the lowest marks, but it wasn't the album people were hoping for. And she's taking it to stadiums this summer after she's pivoted so far from pop and all these other arenas of her life. I don't know. I'll be very curious to see if this thing is a giant disaster or not.
Joe, to pick up on your point, in a perverse way, and to tie this to the TikTok question as well, that generation of artists is like actually too big to succeed. What the requirements to be an Adele are so big, but the industry is not moving really in that specific direction, unless you're Harry Styles, in which case you sell out 15 nights at the Forum and 15 nights at the Garden. That's the Adele. Like, what's wrong with Adele? It's that Harry Styles is Adele. That's the actual problem right now, is that Harry Styles is Adele. But I do think that there is a lack of nimbleness that artists of that scale basically tend to have. And that's more of a liability now than it's ever been. It's always been a problem, but the system is increasingly designed or decreasingly designed to support them. Do you think that the Adele fiasco with the live things getting canceled, does that seem like a long-term issue? Because also to Joe's point, this Adele record was big for sales, but there's no ongoing hits from that record.
The way she's conducted her entire career has been exceptionally old-fashioned. And it's worked up until now because I guess it wasn't that challenged, or the songs were so good and the goodwill for her was so strong. But she put out an album with very little online presence. It was fine, but it wasn't the kind of blockbuster the last one was. She wasn't able to tour it the way she has in the past. And it just sank and it's gone. I don't really think that there's any Adele songs in the consciousness. There was no one song from that album that held on for 6 months that was really like the song of the year. To me, I think the entire proposition is actually in jeopardy.
And I think the Vegas show is a good stand-in for all of that.
Totally.
I agree.
I say go easy on her.
Fine, JP.
No, but the thing is, the idea that you need an ascending curve for a career, that the next album has to be bigger than the last album, it just doesn't happen. It didn't happen to Michael Jackson. You can take a, pardon the expression, artistic left turn, and you'll have your core fans. And then if you reemerge as a pop blockbuster, fine. And if you don't, you follow your own path. I don't see anything dreadful about not outselling your previous album all the time, unless your music gets mediocre. I mean, that Adele album.
Oh, I agree.
Yep.
That album's not mediocre. That album is just not made for TikTok.
And I hope we'll continue to get more interesting music from all of those people in the back half of their career because they're no longer trying to reach those same heights once they realize it's not possible. But I think up until this moment, they have been. And maybe Beyonce was early on that, right? Like stopping trying to top herself commercially to do it creatively and was successful. So I think hopefully, yeah, we'll see a lot more of that as those stars continue to age.
But also you don't want to test yourself against stadium ticket sales because then you're setting yourself up to fail.
That'll tell you real fast where you stand in the culture. Speaking of artists having mid-career shifts or late career quasi-renaissance, Thomas Hira says, a lot of the dialogue around the Red Hot Chili Peppers album is that it sounds like they tried to make an album that still sounds like Frusciante era Red Hot Chili Peppers. Is this derivative critique a fair way to judge this collection of songs? Is it or is it not an ambitious project? Did anybody listen to the Red Hot Chili Peppers record?
So I attended a virtual listening of the Red Hot Chili Peppers record where it was played over Zoom with, I believe it was Chad and Flea introducing the songs. And I didn't like it on the virtual listening, and I haven't really given it much time since then. And I have to say, I was like gobsmacked when it opened so big.
I had to be honest, I did not listen to this record. I asked my friend Yossi, who really cares about Red Hot Chili Peppers, I basically asked this question, and Yossi's response was, it's an extension of Frusciante era Red Hot Chili Peppers, because Frusciante is back with the band, so it sounds like the natural evolution and is not meant to be an obvious throwback, but that is meant to be from the same grammar parts as Frusciante era Red Hot Chili Pepper, and therefore calling it derivative misses the point. Now, do with that information what you will, but what I will not do with that information is listen to the Red Hot Chili Peppers album.
Weirdly, I think because he's a good writer, I read former Popcast guest Sam Sadomski's Pitchfork review of the Red Hot Chili Peppers album, which I thought was really good and the perfect sort of marriage, going back to our question about what music criticism should be, of tracking the band and their personnel drama and the Frusciante stuff and what they've meant over the years, and also how the album sounds, and being able to join those two conversations in one piece of coherent criticism. I recommend reading that review instead of listening to the album.
What was the number?
Who cares?
Wow.
6.4. Okay, I'm guessing. Gabby Iorio wants me to explain my obsession with Addison Rae tweets. And this is a fair question. This is fair. This is a fair getting called to the carpet. If anybody follows Addison Rae on Twitter, I sometimes feel like these artists are complaining about the labels making them be on TikTok. When I read Addison Rae's Twitter, I feel like it's a hostage situation with a management company telling her that she has to perform on Twitter. And it's incredibly random, nonlinear, incomplete. It's sentence fragments. It's a lot. It's a lot of mess. It brings me a lot of joy. It's pure. My relationship to it is pure. That's what I have to say about it. And that's it. That's the end of the Addison Rae Twitter discourse. Oh, Joe, you have something to say on the Addison Rae Twitter discourse?
I just wanted to say it's Addison Rae ebooks.
Yeah. It's exactly right.
It's just like bot Addison.
And I don't know if she's doing it. I don't know if her assistant's doing it. I don't know if an intern in the Dubai office is doing it. Like, I have no idea. Whatever it is, it's magical. I hope it never stops. Anytime I see a regular, normal tweet with photos, I'm just like, oh, I hope this isn't really where we're going with this. Go back to the weird stuff.
Can I tell you what the rating on the Chili Peppers album was? Because I Googled it while you were discussing that. You were so close. 6.2.
Yep. Yep. I see
very
you.
Close.
I see you, P4K. Stephen Peeler says, my question is simple. What is the point of putting out an album? This question came to mind after seeing the negative reception of Jack Harlow's recent album. We have made it this far into the mailbag and not mentioned Jack Harlow. I think an artist like Jack suffers when his music is heard in the album format. Oh, I like Jack Harlow. And there isn't much that is too deep about his lyrics or beats. It feels like we are listening to... It feels like we are listening to a mediocre playlist put together by a manager at a big box retailer. While I think he has enough talent to improve on this, he has been much more successful when he just puts out singles, blah, blah, blah. Why would you put out an album? Joe, let me ask a logistics question before we get into like a aesthetics philosophy question. Most record contracts are structured around albums still, even though the nature of music release is moving away from albums, but the deals themselves are still album deals. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think people have tried to do like years. I remember going back to the Taylor Swift, Big Machine, Scooter Braun conversation when they were trading the contracts back and forth in public. One of the things was that Big Machine had offered her like an annual deal, like she was a baseball player, instead of an album-based deal. And I think that's an interesting concept. I don't know where it's going. But yes, it's true. Albums are like the deliverable product, I think. Tours are linked to albums. You can get radio and streamers excited by saying, this is the album. This is the highlighted track from the album. Like, you know, it's just things move slow and are old fashioned. But I don't know. I mean, there aren't that many big singles right now either. So maybe we're going to like retrench in the album format. Like when I think of the projects I care about from this year, Rosalia, Motomami, the Ethel Cain album, Preacher's Daughter, like those are front to back albums with no streaming hit. And I like them more than any sort of one-offs that I've heard this year. So I think it depends on what kind of artist you are. But I agree that no one needs to hear an hour and 12 minutes of Jack Harlow.
Although let's listen to 12 seconds of Dua Lipa by Jack Harlow. Fade away, I left that Lucania bucket. I heard from someone you say you could be us. Nothing, you know my city like the new Korea. Bust it. All these discussions over who. JP, what do you make of this kind of philosophically? Joe brought up the annual, the idea that you would sign a term deal with a label. And frankly, with the way that a lot of artists are dripping out music these days, I'm very surprised that more people aren't signing those kinds of contracts. I imagine they're a little bit messy in terms of what the nature of the deliverables might be over the course of a year. But still, I think that's the direction it's likely things will move in. But do you think essentially we could arrive at a place where albums, as we understand them, and certainly like where all the people who like dragged me on Twitter after I told Gilbert in that Q&A last year that albums are dying, as those people understand them, do you think that will go away? Do you think 10 to 15 years from now, it's going to seem utterly antiquated for someone to come along and be like, yes, I put out 5-6 singles over the course of a year, and now I am gathering them up with 10 songs you'll never listen to and releasing it as an album. Do you think that's where we're heading?
I think just some people are better at Lucy's and some people are better at big statements. The Ethel Cain album works better as an album. Those songs talk to each other. The Kendrick Lamar album has to exist as an album. Those songs converse with each other. Jack Harlow, not so much. But the Rosalia album, you do want to hear all the things she's trying. And when you hear one crazy idea bounced off all the other crazy ideas, it makes each song better. There has always been the single plus filler album. And that's a bedrock of the music business. I don't think the album is ever going to go away because it's a good artistic unit. I don't think everybody should do it.
The third option I think we're seeing, right, is the growing album or the playlist. I remember when Benny Blanco was putting out his first music under his name, he was telling me he wanted to do it as a playlist, 5 songs and then 5 more songs and then 5 more songs. You've seen a couple artists, indie artists, do that with 3 EPs that become an album. You have the Kid Laroi model, the F Love stuff. And now you have the deluxe album, right, where the album just keeps growing over time. And I'm actually surprised we haven't seen more of that. But I think we'll continue to see some innovation in that space where albums are basically living and breathing playlists. A shout out to Donda 2. Remember Donda 2?
I do not. And I do think some of what you're describing, Joe, ties into just the specifics of the contracting. Because I think if you're signed to like an old style contract, there may not be room for this kind of innovation. But maybe if you're innovating your contract, then you can innovate the nature of your album release. Amanda Montgomery has 2 questions. The first, and my TikTok heads will understand this, would you rather never slay again or slay so hard, everyday slay loses all meaning? Anybody? Karen?
Nope.
I personally would rather slay so hard every day that all slayage loses meaning. I think that's the only right answer to this question. It's bizarre to me that there's a lot of discourse around this because there's clearly only one answer. The other question that Amanda has is, wondering your thoughts on the latest Rina Sawayama and what it would take to really establish her as a main point of current pop conversation. What are we as a society doing to help Rina reach her deserved level of appreciation? I know what me and Karen are doing. Me and Karen are going to the Rina Sawayama show at Brooklyn Steel a few weeks ago. That's what we're doing. Karen, what do you make of this?
I think she's in between moments, and she announced an album for the fall, and I think it has the potential to be pretty big. There's a pretty barren release schedule that we're looking at, and I think her energy and her genre clashing and, I don't know, just everything about the vibe that she's bringing to her show right now, I think this could be her moment. Are we as a society keeping Rina down?
I don't know.
What is our reader suggesting?
My only kind of like hedge on Rina, who I like a lot, and this is something that we talked about briefly after the show, Karen. There was something, look, obviously we're in a peak era of people sampling old songs, people sampling hits, reggaeton performers, hip hop performers. Everybody is sample drill, like revisiting the past in an extremely literal way by being like, that song, you like Glamorous by Fergie? Great. You're going to love First Class by Jack Harlow. There's a lot of extraordinarily literal sampling happening. Rina does something that I think is slightly parallel to that. There is almost a sampling of an era, a sampling of a genre, a sampling of an idea. And sometimes when I was watching the new Rina material live, or the newer Rina material live, or recent, I should say, there were moments where I like almost couldn't quite tell, is this a direct reference to a song from 1987, or is this just an extraordinarily carefully drawn pastiche of what music of that era sounds like. And I think it's so expertly done that I almost can forgive it. But I did have flickers during that show of feeling like I would love to see one click of innovation, one click of pushing further beyond that thought pattern. But in general, I think Rina's a very good singer, very good songwriter, and the songs are good. So my hope is that it's all going to go in a positive direction. But that is like the one kind of like caution note that I had after that show. Karen, what did you think of the show? Also, it was like a big old to-do, big old like fun performance, like dancers and band and the whole thing.
It was very much in conversation with the Charlie XCX show, which was a slightly larger venue. So that was at Hammerstein, and this was at Brooklyn Steel. So Hammerstein is considerably bigger. But I felt like they were both really good pop shows geared towards the size of the stage that they were on. Very often you see a pop show that's like just not working in terms of its scale. That's, I think, part of why the Dua Lipa show didn't work for us so well in an arena. It felt like it would have worked better in a Hammerstein. I think like just having one or two musicians or one or two backup dancers, enough interaction with the crowd where I'm here and I'm certainly, it has a club vibe, but not so much preaching, especially Lady Gaga style self-empowerment stuff, which can go on for like 20 to 30 minutes at her shows. I think Rina struck that balance really well. She felt like in touch with the crowd, but also above it. I thought it was really well done. It was like, it had a bit of spectacle. There were some costume changes. There were some cool lighting effects. She had great dancers, but it wasn't like, oh, I'm waiting for this giant spectacle to wow me. She was really the center point of energy the whole time. The Charlie show was really similar. I couldn't believe how successful I thought it was. She really just bounced around with two dancers the whole time. She did a lot of choreography, which I'd never seen her do before. And it felt very polished and yet extremely chaotic and grimy in that Charlie way at the same time. They worked together on the last record. I think they're in conversation a lot with where they are in their careers, actually, even though they're in very different points of their careers. This is Rina's second album, and Charlie's been putting out music for a really long time. I know I think they're tapping into something very similar with the audiences. They're both very queer crowds, very queer forward shows. But I was super impressed. I'll be looking forward to this album in the fall.
Also, the one thing I would add about Rina, and this is true of the last album and also the show, which is a lot of times when you have pop musicians who are like making commentary on pop from within, and I think Charlie can fall into this, you note the commentary. Rina is making commentary on pop that does not sound like commentary. It sounds pure and true, and yet is still commentary. And I think that balance is extraordinarily difficult, and I think she does a great job of it. Like, it's really impressive.
Totally agree with that, and I would toss Christina and the Queens into that metric as well.
All right.
I look forward to the Rina Gex podcast later this summer or fall.
Let's go. Let's effing go. All right, last question. And Karen, these, they're for everybody, but really they're for you. There's two questions. They're related from different people. Pop-minded, which I assume is an entity, not a person, but who knows? Would love to hear your thoughts on Kelly Clarkson's career arc, pivoting from pop star to daytime talk show host. Also, what do you think of Kelly's cover project? Any thoughts on what sound you'd like to hear on her next album? That's one. Two, Joseph Doherty would like to say, Jordan Sparks started her career with 5 consecutive top 20 hits on the Billboard Hot 100. 5, all caps, I swear, exclamation point. What does her success represent? What does it mean to the history of popular music? Why did it fade? Blah, 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 blah. What do we think of Jordan Sparks? This is not a very contemporary question. Sorry about that. Do not be sorry, because any opportunity to have Karen Gans talk about Jordan Sparks is an opportunity I will take. Karen, either both of those questions, tell us your truest thoughts.
Well, early Idol had so much firepower. There was so much gas in that car that a lot of the, you know, early winners or people that were runners up or almost has-beens from that show, they had like extremely deep runs that happened maybe during the first 6-7 seasons. Scotty McCreery, I still get Daughtry press releases. Every time I get an Idol adjacent person.
Shout out Daughtry.
I love Daughtry. He was great.
A G, a real G.
Jordan Sparks was good, but I felt never really developed a full artistic personality beyond that. I mean, that's also the Idol conundrum, is that unless you really are a true artist and you know what direction you're going to go, you get famous singing cover songs. People are connecting with you half because they like your voice and the way you're singing that song, and then maybe half because they like the specific personality-driven aspect that you're bringing to it, that's bringing it to life. You're not doing any original artistry on that show, which makes Kelly such a standout. I'll pivot now. I'm thrilled for Kelly. She does seem poised to be stepping into the Ellen DeGeneres spot in daytime, but she has a karaoke, which she's extremely devoted to, the karaoke that she sings on her show. This is a huge part of the vibe. She's never let go of the thing that really connected to us in the first place. And I admire her so much for it. Kelly is like the ultimate fan. She's covering Billie Eilish. She's covering Madonna. She's covering everyone.
Radiohead.
Yes, Radiohead. Thank you. I'm like, there's a couple of really good ones that I'm not thinking of. She's so good. And anytime I see that she's covered something, I just know that it's coming so pure from the heart. When she was on tour, she would force her band to learn these songs day of, and she would do a different cover every night in a different city. Keeps her mentally sharp, keeps the band sharp, keeps her in conversation with all different kinds of music. I love her so much. I liked her last album a lot. That was like a throwbacky soul thing. I interviewed her for that album. She was like, I love Aretha Franklin. I'm trying to embody that moment. Didn't really go anywhere. Now, obviously, a post-divorce album is on the horizon.
Yeah, I was going to say, what sound? Do you think that's a soul record? Is that a country record? Is that a kind of like adult contemporary standards record? Like, where do you think her best seat is going to be?
I just want to say we've answered a Kelly Clarkson question exactly like this on every single podcast. Yep, and yep. I love it and keep going.
Yes, never stop.
I'm always here for it. My personal dream would be that she makes the pop punk album. I'd love to hear 12 versions of Gone. I love that song. I'd love to hear Kelly express herself that way.
Featuring Olivia Rodrigo?
I mean, I'd be open to that.
Are the real heads calling since you've been gone?
No. There's also a song called Gone. Which maybe we should play right now to prove the point.
Okay, this is Kelly Clarkson Gone, just to prove that it exists, number one. You know you can't.
Okay, great song. And a lot of this energy was on All I Ever Wanted, my favorite Kelly Clarkson album. My dream would be for her to do that. I feel like age-wise and emotion-wise, she's moved past that phase of her life. So I really have no idea what her divorce album is going to sound like. It could be a country album. That would be amazing, too.
I have a thought on this, which is the last Kelly Clarkson album that was the one you're talking about, I did not think was successful. But what I did think was successful was the Christmas album, which also includes some like broken relationship bangers in a kind of classic singing standards mode. And I thought that Kelly singing standards about divorces in a holiday stylee were incredibly successful. And maybe that's a path of the divorce record.
Another fixture of podcasts is John saying that someone's Christmas album is better than their previous album.
Literally, I was going to say, if a Kelly Clarkson question doesn't elicit the most true selves of me and John Caramonica, that is really, if you just want to see a mirror of our soul, ask us about Kelly Clarkson.
I like Yeet. I like Jack Harlow. I like Kelly Clarkson. We exist. That's just, I just want to say that we exist.
Can't wait for the Yeet Christmas album. Really blow your mind.
literally, you talk of, first of all, it's already a Christmas song. Here's a bell. Like literally, it's already a Christmas song. Here's silver bells. Thank you. I appreciate it. I am retired. JP, any thoughts on Jordan Sparks or Kelly Clarkson that you want to share before we free everyone today?
Kelly Clarkson could do the 100 Gex collaboration too.
She really could.
Yes, absolutely. Kelly Clarkson and Rebecca Black and 100 Gex. I cannot wait. It's exactly what I've been waiting for. That is our show. What a joy and a privilege it is to see everybody except for Karen, who I don't see. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us podcast@nytimes.com. Get in the Facebook group, get in the Discord. And that is an admonishment to myself as well. I will try to be in the Discord more. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Oh, I said that already. Subscribe to Copcast. Anywhere you get your audio content, Apple, Google, Stitcher, etc. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. Let's go out with some vintage Jordan Sparks, which I think we all need to hear as a kind of amuse after this episode. This is Tattoo. No matter what you say about love.